As America begins the celebration of its 250th birthday, Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum thought it would be appropriate to create our own recognition of this important milestone. Welcome to Vashon 250, a look back at what was happening in America 250 years ago and comparing it to what has happened over the past 250 years of American history, what is happening in our current political life, and how these ideals and events have been reflected in the history of our own Vashon Island. I'm John Flora, and I'm joined by my colleague, resident historian, Bruce Hallman.
Thanks, John. Our approach to Vashon 250 during this 250th year of the United States of America as an independent nation uses the Declaration of Independence as an aspirational mission statement, the Constitution as a working user's manual, and the events of the American Revolution as a guide to help us understand who we are as a nation, how we came to be who we are, and how Vashon Island fits into this larger narrative structure.
Today, we get to go back to our elementary social studies class and look at the May 10, 1773 Tea Act, which led to the December 16, 1773 Boston Tea Party. So let's look at the Tea Party, or the Tea Act, rather. The Tea Act was a law passed by the British Parliament that allowed the British East India Company to sell tea directly to the American colonies, bypassing colonial merchants and making the tea cheaper. By reducing the cost of tea, the Act aimed to make British tea more appealing compared to smuggled Dutch tea and bring more profits to the British East India Company that had 17 million pounds of tea stored in England. The North administration hoped to assert Parliament's right to levy direct revenue taxes on the colonies. For the colonists, and particularly colonial merchants, it was a further example of taxation without representation, and of Britain's continued taxation tyranny. And that led us up to the Boston Tea Party, December 16, 1773. Initiated by the Sons of Liberty, it escalated hostilities between the colonists and the British government. Disguised as Native Americans on the night of December 16th, members of the Sons of Liberty boarded the Dartmouth, a merchantman that had docked in Boston carrying a major shipment of East India Company tea, and set about throwing 342 chests of tea into Boston Harbor. The tea was worth close to 10,000 pounds, which in today's values is about $1.8 million. At the time, its action was known as the destruction of the tea, and only later in the early 1800s, as it became a legendary revolutionary event, did it become known as the Boston Tea Party. The price of legally imported tea was actually reduced by the Tea Act of 1773. Protesters were instead concerned with a variety of other issues, including the two challenges confronting the British government under Lord North. First was finding a solution to the financial problems of the East India Company, and the second was an ongoing dispute about the extent of Parliament's authority over the American colonies without the colonies having any elected representatives, hence taxation without representation. The Boston Tea Party united Parliament in London, and they responded to the Boston Tea Party with the Intolerable Acts, which we will discuss 2 weeks from now after we talk next week about Patrick Henry and the, quote, "Give Me Liberty" speech. As an aside, when you visit Boston, you can visit the site of the Tea Party, which includes replica ships, interactive exhibits, and, of course, the gift shop. It's worth a visit if you're seeing the historic sites of Boston, the Old North Church, Bunker Hill, the Freedom Trail, Paul Revere's house, and the list goes on. Again, when you travel, look at what's going on and what was going on. It makes you a better person.
And we'll come up in later episodes, we'll talk about those places, you know, Lexington and Concord and Paul Revere and, you know, those kind of things. But it's also important to recognize about the Tea Act and Boston Tea Party is that the Tea Act actually reduced the price of tea. And you would think, well, colonists would welcome that. But it's that sense of, you know, just the economics of an incident are not necessarily the key to understanding the incident. it wasn't that tea was cheaper for the colonists. It was the fact that even though it was cheaper, it still represent British control over their taxation without their voice. And British actions designed to support the British East India Tea Company, basically a mercantile corporation, if you will, in the face of colonists having to pay this tax, even though it was less than they were paying in the past. So it's not always about economics. Sometimes
no, that was
it's
huge
about,
symbolism.
Yeah, there's a symbolism to it. And when we think about current times and current sort of trade policies, which we'll talk about later in this episode, it's not always about the cost of things that is the key.
So let's base these next comments on what happened over the next 250 years of American history. How do these early events echo what's happened since?
Well, and of course, the Tea Party itself, you know, sort of this rising up, if you will. There's a number of slave revolts that occur in the South prior to the Civil War. And of course, one of the most famous is the Nat Turner Rebellion of 1831. You know, Nat Turner, a slave who basically gathers an army of freed slaves, slaves who freed themselves, gathered arms, and carried out an armed insurrection to gain their freedom. And of course, it was put down very violently by the colonial militias. But it's that sense of people, when they're imprisoned, when they're enslaved, when they feel they're abused, like the Bostonians did with the Tea Act, people will rise up and people will resist. And then the Nat Turner Rebellion is a great example of that. We also have the example in 1894 of Coxey's Army. You know, one of those things that you may have heard about, as John said, you know, in your eighth grade history class, but, you know, vaguely remember it. And it sort of was a result of the 1893-94 depression in the United States, when activists Jacob Coxey and Carl Brown wanted the government to provide jobs for the unemployed. They led a group to Washington, D.C. to ask for help. The group became known as Coxey's Army. Politicians and the media described the army as tramps and vagrants, and they were considered dangerous. They set up camps near Washington, D.C. They held protests for nearly 2 months. And, of course, that kind of thing just terrified the government in Washington, D.C. Since 1882, speeches and protests at the U.S. Capitol were illegal. And so Coxey was arrested for walking on the grass of the Capitol and having a banner, which was just a pin on his jacket. He was also stopped from giving a speech at the Capitol building. Soon it became clear that no policies would change. The protesters were forced to leave when the Virginia militia came in and burned their camp down. And so you have this idea of here's a group of unemployed people in the midst of a Great Depression. I mean, the 1883 Depression was the worst depression in the United States up until the Great Depression of the 1930s. And so it was a serious time. Vashon's population, which was very small, actually dropped from about 900 to about 200 during this time because there were no jobs. And so people left the island to seek jobs other places. And so what you get is this sense of the government putting down a resistance, a protest, and doing it by basically burning the camp and running people off. You have another example in the 1930s, which is often known as the Bonus March. After World War I ended in 1918, veterans were promised bonuses that would be paid in 1945. But when the Great Depression hit in the 1930s, many veterans needed the money sooner. And so what you got in May of 1932, a group led by Walter Waters from Portland, Oregon, led a group to Washington, D.C. to ask for their money early. The Bonus Army camped near the U.S. Capitol for nearly 3 months. Not clear how big the crowd was, but probably somewhere around 10 to 20,000 veterans participated. At the time, protests at the Capitol were technically illegal, but they were common in Congress and often allowed. The Bonus Army even got help from the D.C. police chief to sort of organize and sort of set up camps. Congress was divided on providing the bonus, and the House of Representatives passed the legislation it provided, but it did not pass the Senate. So ultimately, Congress did not give the veterans their bonus money early. As a result, what happens is that the concern grew about this group of 20,000 or so protesters camped on the streets of Washington, D.C., and also fears that the communists were part of the group. Remember, this is the 1930s. It's only 10 years, 15 years after the Russian Revolution. And communism was in the Red Scare of the 1920s were still very prominent in people's minds. And at the time, First Amendment rights could be limited if there was a clear and present danger of harm to the public safety or national security. Today, it's much harder to limit these First Amendment free speech rights. But at the time, the Supreme Court had ruled that they could be limited. And so President Herbert Hoover ordered the police and the army to get rid of the protesters. General MacArthur and his aide, Dwight D. Eisenhower, led the army into Washington, D.C., and they basically destroyed the camps, cleaned them out, burned them down, and moved these protesters out of the city. Many people were shocked by this treatment of veterans. I mean, these are people who basically given their service to the United States, had been promised these bonuses, were asking for the bonuses early. And yet, the U.S. Congress refused to give them to them early. And rather than sort of listening to their protests, the government decided to just, suppress them and move them out. And so it becomes a very important sort of test and the beginning of the change of how we view First Amendment rights in terms of protest.
So let me interrupt you there. The Coxey's Army in 1894 mm-hmm. was at the time of a Great Depression. Mm-hmm. And then we go ahead to the Bonus March back in the Great Depression in the 30s. Mm-hmm. Is it coincidental or a lot of these actions around the time of economic strife?
No, it's not. It's not a coincidence. I mean, it's sort of like important to remember that you didn't have a strong labor movement at this time. The American labor movement is just beginning in the late 19th century. During the 1930s, it's really a time in which labor unions fight for the rights to strike and are granted the rights to strike through National Labor Act laws and those kinds of things. And so, it's not by accident. And it's also not by accident that you see similar kinds of things happening after 2008 and the economic collapse and the Occupy Wall Street movement. Mm-hmm. So, depressions and people being stressed economically and turning basically to the streets as a way to voice their protest when no other avenues are available, is totally understandable.
It's also interesting, I have to admit, I did not know about MacArthur and Eisenhower, right. Two giants that went on to become heroes. Well,
yep, right. Yep.
Sort of, at least in MacArthur's case. But had it not been for World War II, right. Maybe people wouldn't have forgotten so quickly about their actions here.
Right, exactly. So you also in the post-World War II period, you also get other kinds of protests that become sort of turning points in many ways for American history. One is the Stonewall Uprising, June 28th through July 3rd, 1969, New York City. Today the First Amendment really protects gatherings and expressions, in a way that it didn't in the 1890s and the 1930s, and even in the 1960s. That begins to change with the protests of the civil rights movement and the protests of the anti-Vietnam War movement, and as a result of these LGBTQ plus Stonewall uprising in 1969. There were laws at the time that made it hard for gay people to gather. Laws, sodomy laws, and laws persecuted LGBTQ plus people. And the Stonewall Inn in New York City was a gay bar, basically. One morning in June 1969, the police raided the bar, and people in the club for the first time fought back. A six-day uprising followed with violent clashes between the police. Meanwhile, people distributed pamphlets in support of gay rights. The uprising helped to spur a broad gay rights movement. And within a year, New York had three gay newspapers. And it's really, Stonewall is often looked to as the beginning of the modern LGBTQ plus movement, and sort of the gay rights movement, if you will. The uprising upheld a broad gay rights movement. Within a year, New York had begun to change its law. And in 2016, the Stonewall Inn became a historic landmark. Today, the Stonewall Uprising is remembered through parades and marches and generally throughout the country in June as Gay Pride Month. So these insurrections, if you will, or these protests, if you will, often have a fundamental place to play in changing American attitudes. Same thing goes on with the Kent State shootings in May of 1970. Four students at Kent State University died. Nine were injured when they were shot by the Ohio National Guard during a protest against the Vietnam War. The incident shocked people and showed the divisions that were growing in the country over the war. A photograph of the aftermath of the shooting, many of you may be familiar with it, a student lies shot on the ground, one of his fellow students, a young woman, stands throwing her arms up in the air in anguish. It won a Pulitzer Prize, but those images are seared into the memory of the American public and into the idea of what it means to protest actions of the American government and what's a proper response by the government to these kinds of actions. So what you have is a broad range of sort of activities, if you will, of people protesting from the Boston Tea Party, to Nat Turner's Rebellion, to Coxey's Army, to the Bonus March of the 1930s, to the Stonewall Uprising in 1969, to the Kent State protests in 1970. And what you get is just this sense that American attitudes are beginning to change, Americans' approach to protests, and the legal rights of Americans to protest are all beginning to change. And underlying this all, of course, is the post-World War II 1950s and 60s and 70s American civil rights movement that leads to a broad range of rights movements for Native American rights, Asian Pacific Islander rights, rights for LGBTQ plus people. Just a whole range of rights movements emerge in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, and of course the women's rights movement. And so what you get is a shift in attitudes in the United States about what it means to protest, what it means to have the right of free speech, and it all traces back to the Boston Tea Party.
And if we look at all that, the folks in Boston had a printing press or however they printed things. They communicated that way. Mm-hmm. And as time has gone on, if you look at the Kent State time, that was on the evening news mm-hmm. with Walter Cronkite and all the guys, Huntley Brinkley. And we saw them also in Vietnam. So we watched the first war on television, and we read about it in the newspapers. And you had the Pulitzer Prize winning photograph that ended up all over the place and still pops up from time to time. But the I guess, technology of communication changed, and how we looked at it changed. And it educated us in a different way and shaped us in a different way. And it continues to do so today. Arguably, I think there's some question as to whether it's as effective, because we have so much now with all of the cable channels and all of the different things. But when you look at the impact that Walter Cronkite and company had on this country, it's pretty remarkable. And it helped change a lot of the way we look at things.
It is, and what we're dealing with is that change away from that big shift in the communications and the immediacy of communications on a national level that occurs after World War II. Really starts in the 20s and 30s with the introduction of radio, but introduction of television and television networks and national news, those kind of things, really begin to shift that. And then in the 1990s, of course, with the introduction of the internet, and particularly in the 2010s with the introduction of sort of a wide range of social media, you get another shift, and we're in the midst of that shift right now. That's why it's so difficult to understand and really interpret what's going on right now, because we're in the middle of it, and yet we're also seeing a radical change in the way people communicate, in the way people get their news or get their information, and how diverse that has become. And as a result, how, you know, sort of jumbled that information has become. And you see that basically in two major things that I think really define the sort of modern era of political communication. And one is the rise of the Tea Party movement, in 2010, basically. After 27, 28, you have this formation of a sort of organized right wing of the Republican Party that calls themselves the Tea Party and begins to establish a line of interpretation of American politics that's very much outside of the mainstream of American politics. And at the same time, you get the development of a modern leftist communication system in the United States with things like the Occupy Wall Street movement and right now the protest against ICE and the kind of occupations that are occurring in Minneapolis. And what you get is this sort of bifurcation of the American political communication system. And it's largely no longer in the hands of major media sources. Sort of on the right with Fox News, and on the left, some would argue, with the major news networks. But those are losing their influence because there's so many other forms of communication, so many avenues of communication. And what it's doing is it's sort of losing that common national rhetoric and that common sort of understanding of a narrative stream in American politics. And it's being interpreted as highly partisan. And that's really part of what we see right now going on in the United States with the very deep political divisions that we have.
Well, and if you just look in our local area, and it's replicated all over the country, but just take radio, and the radio stations in the Seattle-Tacoma area are owned largely by about four or five large companies. Mm-hmm. And there is very little, and they can argue till the cows come home, but there is very little community input to this. And so do you really learn about what's going on from our media sources, or is it just sort of pablum? I would argue the latter, but I still think there's a place for community radio, and we do it right here. We can have these discussions.
Exactly. And that's why Voice of Vashon has such an important role to play on Vashon, and why other sort of community forms, you know, the community council, the nonprofits, you know, the churches. I mean, there's all these sort of traditional forms of social communication that are available on Vashon, and they all play an important role in sort of offsetting the noise, if you will, that comes from this sort of bifurcation of major national communications.
So before we get too far along here, let's talk about tariffs. Mm-hmm. We hear a lot about it now, but in fact, back in the 30s, Herbert Hoover was convinced to sign the act for the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act of 1930 that raised tariffs to protect American industries. And that involved something like 20,000 different products imported from all over the place. He was advised not to do it by his close advisors, but there were a bunch of people that really wanted to see it happen to protect their business and so on and so forth. Ultimately, he signed it, and it was a policy misstep because what it did was just deepen the depression, and it lasted longer because of that. Do we see that same thing happening today?
Well,
or do we know?
Yeah, we're a little bit too close to it right now to know for certain. But what we're seeing is the beginning of the breakdown of the post-World War II sort of sense of an international economy that's linked together for the security of the world. You know, and that's what emerges most strongly after World War II, is the sense that you wanted to have an international system, an international network of trade that sort of lessened the impact of things like the Smoot-Hawley tariffs, and that prevented things like World War II from happening again. And, you know, for what, 60 years, almost 70 years, that system worked. And worked relatively well. I mean, it certainly didn't work well for everyone. It didn't work well for certain sectors of the economy around the world and for certain parts of the world. But it did result in a lack of a world war, similar to what we saw in the 19-teens with World War I, then in the 1930s and 40s with World War II. You certainly had sort of regional wars and sort of wars in certain areas, but what you didn't see was a global conflict going on, and so that's established a stability that I think's important to understand. That what we're seeing right now is that being attacked and that being sort of beginning to break down, and where it's going is very difficult. But in terms of Vashon, important to recognize that Vashon's part of that larger economy. You know, that Vashon, you know, has responded in the past. I mean, when Vashon was threatened with ferry strikes in the 1940s, Vashon stepped up and created their own ferry district. And for almost 5 years, we ran our own ferries until the Washington State Ferry System was created. And there's been a number of protests over the time in Vashon. In the 1980s, 1982, the Peace Walk, in which, you know, schools shut down and people hit the streets to protest, for peace. The Bridge Meeting of 1992, Black Lives Matter sort of shutdowns in 2020. And today, the No Kings sort of protest. So Vashon has a long legacy going back to the Boston Tea Party, not in a violent sense of the Tea Party, but in the sense of Vashon going to the streets to make our sort of opinions known.
And we have a great ability to do that. And with that, thanks for joining us. And that concludes this week's episode. Bruce and I invite you to join us each week for interesting stories about our collective American and Vashon Island heritage. And our programs are available on the Voice of Vashon website at voiceofvashon.org. go to the site and click on your choice of saved programs. If you have a question, comment, or suggestions of a topic, please drop us a note to Vashon250@voiceofvashon.org. That's Vashon250@voiceofvashon.org. Vashon 250 is a presentation of Voice of Vashon, your island connection. The show is produced by Truman O'Brien. Vashon 250 is sponsored by NACM Business Credit Services, a 126-year-old association focused on credit education and professional financial services. NACM serves business, credit, and finance departments across the Fruited Plain. We appreciate their support. And with that, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.